Concurrently with the development of steam transport upon land and sea, a new and striking addition to the facilities of human intercourse arose out of the investigations of Volta, Galvani, and Faraday into the various electrical phenomena. The electric telegraph came into existence in 1835. The first underseas cable was laid in 1851 between France and England. In a few years, the telegraph system had spread over the civilized world, and news which had hitherto travelled slowly from point to point became practically simultaneous throughout the earth. These things, the steam railway and the electric telegraph, were, to the popular imagination of the middle 19th century, the most striking and revolutionary of inventions. But they were only the most conspicuous and clumsy first fruits of a far more extensive process. Technical knowledge and skill were developing with an extraordinary rapidity, and to an extraordinary extent measured by the progress of any previous age. Far less conspicuous at first in everyday life, but finally far more important, was the extension of man's power over various structural materials. Before the middle of the 18th century, iron was reduced from its ores by means of wood charcoal, was handled in small pieces, and hammered and wrought into shape. It was material for a craftsman. Quality and treatment were enormously dependent upon the experience and sagacity of the individual iron worker. The largest masses of iron that could be dealt with under those conditions amounted at most in the 16th century to 2 or 3 tons. There was a very definite upward limit, therefore, to the size of cannon. The blast furnace arose in the 18th century and developed with the use of coke. Not before the 18th century do we find rolled sheet iron, 1728, and rolled rods and bars, in 1783. Nasmyth's steam hammer came as late as 1838. The ancient world, because of its metallurgical inferiority, couldn't use steam. The steam engine, even the primitive pumping engine, couldn't develop before sheet iron was available. The early engines seem, to the modern eye, very pitiful and clumsy bits of ironmongery, but they were the utmost that the metallurgical science of the time could do. As late as 1856 came the Bessemer process, and presently in 1864 the open hearth process, in which steel and every sort of iron could be melted, purified, and cast in a manner and upon a scale hitherto unheard of. Today, in the electric furnace, one may see tons of incandescent steel swirling about like boiling milk in a saucepan. Nothing in the previous practical advances of mankind is comparable in its consequences to the complete mastery over enormous masses of steel and iron, and over their texture and quality which man has now achieved. The railways and early engines of all sorts were the mere first triumphs of the new metallurgical methods. Presently came ships of iron and steel, vast bridges, and a new way of building with steel upon a gigantic scale. Men realized too late that they had planned their railways with far too timid a gauge, that they could have organized their traveling with far more steadiness and comfort upon a much bigger scale. Before the 19th century, there were no ships in the world much over 2,000 tons burthen. Now there's nothing wonderful about a 50,000-ton liner. There are people who sneer at this kind of progress as being a progress in mere size, but that sort of sneering merely marks the intellectual limitations of those who indulge in it. The great ship or the steel frame building isn't, as they imagine, a magnified version of the small ship or building of the past. It's a thing different in kind, more lightly and strongly built, of finer and stronger materials. Instead of being a thing of precedent and rule of thumb, it's a thing of subtle and intricate calculation. In the old house or ship, matter was dominant. The material and its needs had to be slavishly obeyed. In the new, matter has been captured, changed, coerced. Think of the coal and iron and sand dragged out of the banks and pits, wrenched, wrought, molten, and cast, to be flung at last a slender, glittering pinnacle of steel and glass 600 feet above the crowded city. We've given these particulars of the advance in man's knowledge of the metallurgy of steel and its results by way of illustration. A parallel story could have been told of the metallurgy of copper and tin, and of a multitude of metals, nickel and aluminium, to name but two, unknown before the 19th century dawned. It is in this great and growing mastery over substances, over different sorts of glass, over rocks and plasters and the like, over colours and textures, that the main triumphs of the mechanical revolution have thus far been achieved. Yet we're still in the stage of the first fruits in the matter. We have the power, but we have still to learn how to use our power. Many of the first employments of these gifts of science have been vulgar, tawdry, stupid, or horrible. The artist and the adapter have still hardly begun to work with the endless variety of substances now at their disposal. Parallel with this extension of mechanical possibilities, the new science of electricity grew up. It was only in the 80s of the 19th century that this body of inquiry began to yield results to impress the vulgar mind. Then, suddenly, came electric light and electric traction and the transmutation of forces, the possibility of sending power that could be changed into mechanical motion or light or heat as one chose along a copper wire, as water is sent along a pipe, began to come through to the ideas of ordinary people. The British and the French were at first the leading peoples in this great proliferation of knowledge, but presently the Germans, who had learned humility under Napoleon, showed such zeal and pertinacity in scientific inquiry as to overhaul these leaders. British science was largely the creation of Englishmen and Scotchmen, working outside the ordinary centres of erudition. We've told how in England the universities after the Reformation ceased to have a wide popular appeal, how they became the educational preserve of the nobility and gentry, and the strongholds of the established church. A pompous and unintelligent classical pretentiousness dominated them, and they dominated the schools of the middle and upper classes. The only knowledge recognized was an uncritical textual knowledge of a selection of Latin and Greek classics, and the test of a good style was its abundance of quotations, allusions, and stereotyped expressions. The early development of British science went on, therefore, in spite of the formal educational organization, and in the teeth of the bitter hostility of the teaching and clerical professions. French education, too, was dominated by the classical tradition of the Jesuits, and consequently it wasn't difficult for the Germans to organize a body of investigators, small indeed in relation to the possibilities of the case, but large in proportion to the little band of British and French inventors and experimentalists. And though this work of research and experiment was making Britain and France the most rich and powerful countries in the world, it wasn't making scientific and inventive men rich and powerful. There's a necessary unworldliness about a sincere scientific man. He's too preoccupied with his research to plan and scheme how to make money out of it. The economic exploitation of his discoveries falls very easily and naturally, therefore, into the hands of a more acquisitive type. And so we find that the crops of rich men, which every fresh phase of scientific and technical progress has produced in Great Britain, though they haven't displayed quite the same passionate desire to insult and kill the goose that laid the national golden eggs as the scholastic and clerical professions, have been quite content to let that profitable creature starve. Inventors and discoverers came by nature, they thought, for cleverer people to profit by.